I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rich Hill, the documentary, is going to premiere on Independent Lens a week from today, Monday, January 5. The film follows three teenage boys who are growing up poor in America. They're growing up specifically in Rich Hill, Missouri, which is a very, very small town that used to be a mining town, and the coal was mined out shortly after World War II, so finding work has been troublesome ever since. The film won the 2014 Sundance Film Festival Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary, and we have the directors and producers with us this hour of the program. They won, they've won all kinds of awards for the work that they've done. The film I did have a chance to screen over the weekend, and it's very, very moving. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm not sure how many we'll get other than when we talk about these issues. I know you haven't had a chance to see the film yet, but you will a week from today. And so it's a nice preview for you, the audience, too, to find out all that it's about. The directors, producers are with us this hour, Tracy Droz-Tragos and Andrew Droz-Palermo. They are cousins, and Rich Hill, Missouri, happens to be the hometown of their parents. Tracy is an award-winning independent filmmaker. First film was Be Good, Smile Pretty, about the loss caused by the deaths of American men in the Vietnam War some 35 years later. That won that received the 2004 Emmy for Best Documentary, and she is currently in production on two documentaries that focus on the challenges facing girls in America. Tracy, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. And Andrew Droz-Palermo is also with us. He is one of the producers and directors of Rich Hill. He is in post-production now on his narrative feature debut, 1 and 2, a dark fairy tale following two children with unusual abilities. He was honored as one of Filmmaker Magazine's 25 New Faces of Independent Film in 2013. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So it was true that your parents both were born or grew up in Rich Hill, Missouri?
Indeed, yeah. For me, it was my father. And, that was his home. He had the same address, 301 Elm Street, his entire life. He was killed in the Vietnam War, which was part of the journey that I went on to make my first film, Be Good, Smile Pretty. And it also meant that Rich Hill was kind of an extra special place for me because it was a point of connection with him. I was an infant when he was killed, and so I never knew him. Mm. And my relationship with my grandparents, also Andrew's grandparents, was very, very important. They were like surrogate parents to me. And I spent a lot of time there as a kid, straddling my time between Oakland, California, and Rich Hill, Missouri.
Oh, my. And Andrew, your parents?
Yes. My mother, of course, grew up there. And I grew up about 3 hours from Rich Hill in Jefferson City, Missouri, which is the capital. And, of course, we'd go for all the holidays, 4th of July included, which are so heavily featured in our film. And it was always a great chance for me to kind of dust off my outdoorsman stuff and do some fishing and, you know, learn how to shoot BB guns and hang out with our uncle.
Right. And now here you are as cousins making this film together. That must have been just in itself quite an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I have to say it was a really great collaboration, and Tracy, you know, taught me a lot during the process. And documentary is just so much work, and co-directing one is, I think, a necessity at times because there's so much work. And one of the great things was we come from two very different perspectives, and meeting in the middle a lot of times really, I think, helped our film.
Mm-hmm. You pick three people, three kids who are 15 years old, and they're all different. They all really love their families. A couple seem particularly troubled. But as you set the scene at the beginning of the film, these are the places, the trailer parks, some places that may have old cars in front of the yards or a lot of garbage around, the people that we tend to forget, people that are poor, they live in small towns, they live in rural areas, and they really are a forgotten part of America right now, don't you think, Tracy?
Well, yes, that was part of, you know, what we wanted to change in the making of this film was to give these families a voice, to get to know them beyond just, you know, what you might see on the outside, the tarp on the roof or, you know, the broken down car in the front yard, but to get to know them as people. Because, of course, you know, that's the most important thing that they are. It's not all about, you know, the stuff on the outside and that they're struggling with. And indeed, we were welcomed into the homes that that we ended up, you know, chronicling in the film. Really, there was an immense trust that was given to us, and we were honored by it. And they wanted to share their story. They wanted to, you know, have someone bear witness to the struggles that they were facing, and also, you know, the great stuff that they had going on too. Their enormous potential.
Andrew, was there a reason it became aware to me as I watched the film how important that those years are in terms of where you're going to go with your life? But was there a reason you chose 15-year-old boys?
Yeah, there was, you know, it kind of happened somewhat naturally. We were just very drawn to Apache upon first meeting him. And our cousin, who is a gym teacher at the local school, introduced us to him, and he was so rough. You know, his exterior, his skin was chapped, his clothes were ripped up. He, you know, was mentioning how hungry he was, but there was something so very wise about him. And yet he didn't seem like he had lost hope yet. He really still had dreams for himself. And we really found that, you know, all of the kids were this way. And because of that, it made them harder to dismiss. You know, oftentimes people say that adults are living off the system, but, you know, these kids, of course, are not making that choice. If people were, in fact, doing that, which I don't think they do, but, you know, that sort of argument sort of falls away when you're talking about children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we wanted to make a very personal, intimate film. That was a choice we made early on, which meant it was hard. You know, we couldn't overpopulate it with too many stories or outside experts. It was going to be very, very personal. So, you know, we did settle at one point on the experience of boys. And, you know, there were some unique circumstances of that. You know, in part, they had such few, you know, so many few role models. Except for Andrew, there was no active father figure in their lives. They were dealing with a lot of anger and, you know, it was hard to know what to do with that. You know, anger and also hope. You know, it's a hard time in a kid's life, no matter what your circumstances are. But they were also often in survival mode, in a way that made it even harder.
And Apache, I was so struck when he says that, well, he was thinking of moving to China to become an art teacher and draw dragons all day. I never expected that to come out of his mouth.
Yeah, he's a great kid, and I love that, you know, despite everything that's going on within his home, he still really wants to pursue his dreams, and I know everyone can relate to that.
Let's spend some time with Andrew. If I was thinking as I was watching him, Andrew is a really likable young person who seems to be doing the right thing all the time. He works very hard. He's building his body. He cares about his family very deeply. But his father doesn't seem to be able to land any steady work. There isn't much work in Rich Hill, and they go elsewhere, and then he doesn't have any work. And Andrew is moving and moving and moving all this time. So he gets on a football team, and I'm thinking, all right, Andrew, things are going to move ahead for you. And then it's back to another town to yet another school because there's no work. It's just this, I kept thinking, if you had been in a family that could have given you something, you would have been able to have, I don't know, secured a football scholarship or whatever, but life would have been very different.
Yeah, I mean, the transient nature of a lot of these families is really, really tough. I mean, it's tough on the parents, but, of course, it's tough on the kids who are trying to get a foothold. And whether it's, you know, being on a football team or having consistent school records, or in Andrew's case, for his mother, having a kind of consistent medical care or access to her records and, you know, the pain medication that she was on and trying to regulate, I mean, it has ripple effects. When you don't have a foundation of a job and a consistent home and, you know, a way of paying for a home and a way of, you know, driving to work and, you know, all of the things that these families struggle with. You know, when a car breaks down, it's catastrophic because that was the ripple effects that that then has on their lives. You know, I still think that Andrew has a lot of potential, but it is so difficult to see the things that, you know, fall in his path that continue to challenge him. And the fact that he participated in this film, in some measure, I think, you know, his trajectory has shifted, but it doesn't mean that all the problems that he's faced, you know, have gone away. And, you know, he continues to face them, and it's hard to see, for sure.
And then there's Harley. What an interesting young person he is, whose mom's in prison, and you can tell us why in a moment. But he gets so excited about his 16th birthday, and all right, this is going to be a great day for you. And then it was an indication of everything that's so hard for him in his life. It turns out to be a horrible day.
Yeah, I mean, he struggles with so very much, and it's revealed within the film, you know, why Harley is so angry, and, you know, his mother is in prison, and he's living with his grandmother, who's a wonderful woman and is supporting a number of Harley's extended family. And, you know, Harley is, I think, as you'll see in the film, is just this great kid that he loves to tell jokes and really invites everyone to have fun with him. And but, you know, there's a flip side of that for him, in that he's dealing with, you know, traumatic experiences, which make him very angry at times.
Let's talk about the family, the familial bond among all three of the young people who are featured. Harley says at one point where he has to go to the principal's office for the, you know, 25th day in a row or whatever. He just doesn't want to be in school. And he makes the comment to the principal, I don't need education. I just need my family, which was such a profound thing to say when you looked at the fact that his stepfather had done this horrible thing to him. His mom was in prison. And he had his grandmother, but he was just, he didn't have anybody he could completely count on. They weren't there all the time. It was, what a thing to say. I just need my family.
Hmm. Well, you know, they're the most reliable and, you know, comforting. I mean, like for many of us, you know, family may not always do the right thing, but it's often, you know, the people that we return to, the people that know us best. And I think it stems from being in a kind of survival mode. You know, when the chips are down, who else is going to be there for you but your family? And in large part, you know, his family is there for him. His grandmother is an enormous source of support. And it is, you know, in some measure why he doesn't want to be in school is his insecurity about where she is and wanting to be with her, wanting to be with this woman who brings him, is such a source of comfort for him. You know, of course, we wish that kind of that feeling of security he had so that he could also then pursue an education and all of these things that he could do if he wasn't in such survival mode.
Right. And let's talk a little bit more about this town and how typical it may be of many small towns in America. It's really a very small town. My understanding is that coal mining used to be dominant, and then all the coal was mined. Is that right?
Yes, shortly after World War II. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it was a factory town that suddenly, you know, was a boom town and then went bust when the factory closed. It was kind of over time, and Rich Hill is a very average community, like many small towns that, you know, one might drive by or live in or grew up in, you know, or, you know, fly over. I mean, it is not the most poor town in Missouri by any means, and of course there are many states that have, you know, have much deeper poverty. So it's quite average in that, you know, there are few jobs there. Any of the businesses are really clustered around the highway, and there's a Dollar General store. There's a wonderful place to get, you know, it's a mom and pop kind of like a Dairy Queen. It's called Swope's Drive-In, and there's, you know, you can get Susie Q's there, and there's a gas station. And beyond that, you know, most of the people are employed at the school, or they have farms on the outskirts of t- town that maybe have been passed down from generation. It's a place that many low-income families who didn't necessarily grow up there are drawn to now because rents are cheap. It's a very, very inexpensive place to live. Excuse me, but of course, once you get there, you realize that it's a very inexpensive place to live because there are no jobs. And once you're there, and if you don't have a car or don't have money for gas, you're really kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm. They sure do celebrate the 4th of July, don't they?
Indeed, they
yeah,
do.
They really, and it's a really great thing because so many of the outlying communities come in and celebrate, and there's a great fireworks display, and there's bands. But, you know, the thing which was always eerie for us to see is what happens on, you know, July 5th or July 6th when it rolls out of town and, you know, downtown begins, you know, continues to be a ghost town. And it's just, it's eerie to be reminded of you know, how little is going on in Rich Hill outside of the 4th of July.
So really, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tracy.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's a hard thing to knock completely because, honestly, it's a thing that everybody loves, you know, the fireworks. And I remember, and I know Andrew remembers, growing up and, being in Rich Hill for the 4th of July. I mean, who doesn't love fireworks? So it's and who doesn't love going to a carnival when you're a kid? So it's a great thing that happens there. But it's so fleeting. And, of
right.
course, as Andrew said, you know, then the carnival pulls out and what's left. So it'd be nice if a similar kind of attention or there was a similar kind of, you know, resources available for the kids and families year-round, of course.
Right. When you think about the futures of these three young lads, do you imagine that they simply are going to have to live Rich Hill? They won't be able to make a living there?
Well, I mean, even now, Harley has dropped out of school. He's 17, so he has not finished high school, and he is having to drive an hour away to work at a pizza parlor.
Oh my goodness!
So that's some people might be able to get the two or three jobs that there are at the Dollar General or at Swope's, but or if they're educated, can at the high school, but there are very, very few jobs. Certainly not 1,300.
What about Andrew?
I was just going to say that we both have a lot of hope for all three of them. But Andrew has a real interest in cars, and is he obviously, as you see in the film, he learns a lot from his father, who works with his hands and odd jobs and really can fix anything. And Andrew's, been taught a lot of that. And I think he'll find work. And I really hope that he can do something he loves. And I know it might be cars or it might not be. But as you see, he's very, very resourceful. And, we obviously hope the best for him. And
he's a wonderful kid. I mean, there are a lot of things that I think we learned from our time spent with them and the time that we continue to spend with them. It wasn't like, we made the film and then you kind of, drop them and the relationship doesn't continue. The relationship does continue.
It has. That's good to hear.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew in particular is a very optimistic kid. And I think he gets that from his father in some measure, his father who dreams and is, looking for bigger and better, sometimes too much bigger and better, but that has left something, that's had an effect on Andrew, and he does have a sense of optimism. He and I were talking the other day because he has traveled a bit with me on the road with the film, and I've noticed how easily he fits in and talks to different kind of people, and I realize that that's a skill that he picked up, by moving around probably so much. That he's a bit of a chameleon and is able to read a room and know how to be a little bit, which is great and I think will serve him well in his life with whatever he may choose to do. So.
The one who you worry about is Apache because he did have some problems that had been diagnosed, obsessive-compulsive ADHD. I don't know if those were true diagnoses or not, but he just seemed to be so upset, so mad, and in need of help.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the one, I suppose, you know, saving grace is that in the state of Missouri, there is a juvenile justice system which is pretty, which is in pretty good shape. Perhaps surprisingly, I mean, it's a very well-run system with people who do care, and there is a lot of talk therapy, and kids get hugs, and you know, don't have to wear orange jumpsuits, and are not treated like, you know, criminals the way in other states they sometimes are. So when he does go away, he is often in, you know, not a terrible place. But yes, he is someone that, you know, has a real hard time, and he's the youngest. And so, you know, his path to where he's going to be as a grown-up is longer and more
right.
uncertain. I will say that his mother is one of the film's greatest champions, and she's perhaps seen in some might say the harshest light. She's in a very stressful time in her life when we were filming, and she acknowledges that and also talks about her own parenting and her own capacity for change and desire to change. And I'm, you know, I think that that's really, you know, she is working on her parenting. So there's a lot of promise for Apache, too, and for his mom, who is still young, who is in her mid-30s. So she has a lot of life ahead of her, too, I hope.
It was amazing to hear her say that she just didn't ever have a life of her own, that she was 17, she graduated from high school, and she got married, and she was a mom right away. That was life.
Yeah, well, and all the moms in our film, and I feel like their role is pretty significant. They were all teenagers when they became parents, and none of them were able at the time with their circumstances to finish high school. So none of them were able to, you know, get high school diplomas. I think now Harley's quite proud of his mom because in prison she's gotten her GED. So that's something to be proud of. But yes, becoming a parent as a teenager starts a lot of, you know, this cycle of the struggle that these families are in, and it's a hard thing to break out of when that's the reality that, you know, their parents were also teenagers when they had them, and it kind of has a ripple effect. And so I certainly hope, and we've talked a lot with Andrew, Harley, and Apache about, you know, waiting for parenthood a little bit until they're older and
right.
have, you know, figured out what they want for themselves before they have to think about someone else.
We're going to welcome phone calls if you want to join our conversation. I guess the best way to do this, there are small towns, of course, all over our listening area in Wisconsin and beyond. We're talking with the documentarians. The film is Rich Hill, Missouri, and it's going to be the Independent Lens offering next Monday night on PBS. Check your local listings for what time, but it's in the evening. It's a town of just 1,393 people, 70 miles south of Kansas City. And as you heard Tracy describe, there isn't a whole lot in terms of employment in this area. It's a face of more rural, small-town poverty. And the film focuses on three teenage boys and what they are doing in terms of day-to-day life, in terms of education, and in terms of dreams. And it also focuses on their families and the strong bonds shared among family members of these three boys, Andrew and Apache and Harley. So here's our phone number if you'd like to join us. I found it interesting that Andrew has been going around with the film. I know that all three have had a chance to see the film by now, but I'm wondering what they think about it, what people in Rich Hill think about this film as well. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at www. WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Those of you who grew up in small towns and found that you had to leave in order to make a living, does this ring true to any of you? Some of you may have been in exactly the same circumstances that those featured in this film were in or are in. We'd like to hear from you. If not, we'll just talk, because I know you haven't had a chance to see the film yet, but I do hope you will. It's next Monday on PBS. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests are the directors and producers of Rich Hill, Tracy Droz-Tragos and Andrew Droz-Palermo. They're cousins, Rich Hill, Missouri, the hometown of their parents. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm wondering what all three of the teens thought about this film, to have somebody pay so much attention to you and to your life and all of a sudden see that life on a big screen. Must have been quite a moment for each of them, wasn't it, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, they all were able to see it before Sundance, and then we were actually able to bring all of them out to see it at the festival with an audience, and you know, they had a really great time, and I was sitting right behind them at the premiere, and they were laughing and, you know, pointing at each other, and, you know, they had a really great time. And one of the things that I love so much about that experience is that this was really the first time that each of them had known each other's stories as in-depth as they saw on screen, and as a result, they become quite close, and Apache and Harley, you know, had a little sleepover that night, and they were just so bonded because of their experiences, and, you know, they've all said really wonderful things about the film, and that's really one of the best rewards that we've been given.
And what about their families? What did they think? And the town? Tracy?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember asking Harley's grandma, Grandma Betty, what she thought. And this was, I think, we also were able to be together at the True False Film Festival in Columbia, Missouri, which was another, you know, kind of amazing experience for all of us. But I said, you know, do you think this has been a good thing? This has been a little, you know, this has been kind of crazy. And it's not everybody that has a documentary that, you know, is such a, you know, that goes so deep into your lives.
Yes.
And how has it been for you all? And she says, it's been good. And I said, why? And she said, well, you know, these boys, they feel like they belong. And that was very, you know, profound for me. And, you know, of course, you know, these kids and these families, you know, don't always feel like they belong or that their voice matters. They're very disenfranchised, and the notion of being heard and being heard at, you know, the Sundance Film Festival and having people come up and hug them, and, you know, it's a very intangible thing to say, you know, I feel like I belong, or I feel like my future matters, or that people care about me, but it's not an insignificant thing, and certainly we hope that whatever empathy audiences may feel for these specific kids and their families is an empathy that extends beyond them to, you know, to families like them and to communities like Rich Hill.
I think the film really does that. I know that when I drive through many of these small towns, I live in a big city, right in a central city, so my experience is somewhat different. Seeing poverty isn't different, but you tend to pass through these small towns, and I don't think I will again. I'll be looking at the faces of the people that I see, and you'll see them somewhat differently because you have made them important, people that we should be noticing. I'm wondering if people in the high school saw the film. Did the principal see it, and was there a screening at Rich Hill High School?
Well, there has not been a screening yet at Rich Hill High School. You know, we had a Kickstarter campaign at a very crucial point in the making of this film, and there were many, many people in the community that came out, and we sent all of them DVDs and links to the film, and have tried to make the film as available. Of course, we opened in Kansas City and Nevada, Missouri, which have theaters that are right. You know, Nevada is about a half an hour away. Kansas City is the biggest city, and that's about an hour and a half away. And we made sure that, you know, people from the town knew that it was playing and wanted to make sure that they could get there and, you know, could get in for free if they mentioned that they were from Rich Hill. So So we have done that, but we have not screened it at the high school yet. So it's on the bucket list for sure. But I know that the principal was very supportive of our making of the film. We had many conversations before, you know, the one scene that's in the film where Harley is kind of confronted and decides to walk out of school. And you know, he knows what a lifeline the schools are for kids. But he also struggles with his own resources and ability to, you know, provide everything that he can and that the kids need. And, you know, their need is so much greater than what he can, you know, he can give them. And that's right. That's something that he grapples with. You know, they offer lunch and breakfast, and most of the kids qualify to have that, you know, for free because, you know, they can't afford to pay for it. That's, I think, you know, somewhere between 70 or 80% of the kids that go to school don't pay for those breakfasts and lunches during school. But then he knows that for many of them, those are the only meals they're going to have. So, you know, he's got a, you know, for a while he set up a peanut butter and jelly program where they made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches that kids could take home after school and, you know, backpacks for the weekends, but, you know, there aren't enough of those to go around. So it's always, you know, it's a struggle with the need that there is and what they can provide. And it's a matter of resources and funding and all of that.
So what is it? You obviously know most people, probably almost all of the people in Rich Hill. When you look at those people who are able to break out of the town, because it sounds like there's no way to make an income. Maybe there is if you own the pizza parlor or if you own the place that makes great sundaes and cheeseburgers. But in order to have a satisfactory income and even to have a chance to go on to college and enter whatever career you want, how can that happen for young people who live in Rich Hill? How are those doors opened?
I mean, you know, it's not an easy answer. I think it starts with, you know, having a voice. It starts with perhaps some measure of mentorship. And certainly social supports are important. You know, that in the Missouri legislature, they're, you know, debating constantly, you know, whether to, you know, food assistance and minimum wage and expanding Medicaid and, you know, all of these things that, you know, directly affect families and often directly affect children. So it's hard to point at any one policy that would make a difference. But, you know, when kids are hungry or when parents can't, you know, can't get the medical care that they need or when kids can't get the medical care that they need, that often has a catastrophic ripple effect that ultimately, you know, can lead to, you know, a child not going to college or a child not being able to, you know, keep a commitment or keep a job or, you know, so there are any number of places where intervention can happen to improve the lives of kids and to make their futures, you know, brighter. It just takes kind of, you know, a patience and persistence because it's not, unfortunately, it's not one single, you know, it's not one single fix.
Right.
I don't know what you would say to that, Andrew.
Well, I'll just add, I mean, I agree that it's obviously multifaceted, but one of the things that, you know, I might say is also that the thing that makes Andrew so hopeful in the film and I think have such dreams for himself is the support that his own family gives him. And I think that's a really, really crucial thing is that, you know, families really need to help each other and instill dreams within their kids. And even if it's not your own child, if it's your niece or nephew, I mean, you can do so much to help. And I think that's really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that speaks to, honestly, the whole family. And it's not just identifying a need that a child may have, you know, by maybe giving his mother dental care or, you know, helping his father, you're also helping that father's children. And that father's children being able to, you know, go on and do better things. So, yes, and particularly for Andrew, he had two parents who loved him very, very much. Maybe couldn't always provide for him, but that really did you know, make him the person that he is today and might be in the future.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls. Our number, I'll give it to you once again, is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Rich Hill, the documentary. It's going to premiere on Independent Lens next Monday, January 5, on PBS, following three teenage boys growing up poor in America, in Missouri, in Rich Hill, Missouri. The film won the 2014 Sundance Film Festival Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary. And we're speaking with the cousins who did the documentary, Tracy Droz Tragos and Andrew Droz Palermo. Our number, 800-486-8655. Eugene and Viola are first caller. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. I quit high school when I was 16. I was running all over the place. I was 18. I was in Chicago for about a year and a half. And then I was 19. I was sitting in Janesville in a Chevrolet plant, and they hired me with a year and a half of high school. I got a lot of help from a lot of people around me, and I spent managed to finish my high school and was working for Chevy down there. And what got me started was the county normals. I managed to get into go to normal school, and that got me started in education. And I finally got a degree, and then I got a son who graduated from Luther with a major in music.
Hmm.
I got a leg up, but I don't see those situations around anymore where people can get a start. But those institutions, I don't see them being there. That's what I'm saying, I guess, pretty much.
Tracy?
For the younger generation,
right.
So expensive. I mean, I got out of normal school. When I got out of college, I didn't know anything,
well, that
pretty
was
much,
good.
As far as that was concerned.
Yeah,
Tracy?
I mean, I see that, you know, that really is an issue, that a lot of programs and resources are simply not there for kids. And if they're there, you know, there's a stigma associated sometimes with, you know, with needing a leg up, or, you know, it's seen as a handout, right? And that if you have a handout, that there's something, you know, wrong with you, or that there's something shameful about it, or your family, or your parents who need support and, you know, or need a little bit of a help. So, you know, I think that's also factors into, you know, there are fewer programs, and then there is such a stigma in needing or asking for help for many people, because it has you know, it's looked down on.
Mm-hmm. What about going back to school? You mentioned that Harley had left school and was working at the pizza joint an hour out of town.
Yeah.
So he does not have his high school diploma.
No, he does not. He does not. And there are no other educational resources for him right now. I mean, it was kind of a one-size-fit-all. He could have gone to the Rich Hill School and, you know, stayed in school from 9 to 3 or not. And that's, you know, that's where he is. He's old enough now at 17 to officially, you know, drop out without, you know, being reported to a truancy officer. And so that's where he is now. You know, he's someone who would benefit hugely from different educational opportunities, whether it's, you know, a vocational school or something that he could do with his hands. I mean, he's a smart kid. He's great with people. He would be, you know, benefit hugely from other options.
But there just aren't any, are there? There aren't any.
There aren't any. And the other thing that I would say for him that he would benefit hugely from is some measure of mental health, you know, resources. You know, we were quite struck during the making of this. You know, he is on medication, and to have his medication adjusted, there's somebody from Kansas City who drove down an hour and a half to Rich Hill to pick him up, so that he could talk to a therapist on a television screen in the neighboring town, which was in Butler, Missouri, a half hour away, or 20 minutes away. And that therapist was in St. Louis, so he was talking to him. Harley spoke to him on a computer, you know, television screen.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, there just aren't the people and the, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if he could see someone in Rich Hill that, you know, there wouldn't have to be that effort made, and he could have a personal connection with someone who had an interest in him and could, you know, give him a leg up.
Right. Absolutely. When you screen this film and some of the teens are with you, or all of them are with you, or one of them is with you, what do people talk about? What does the audience key in on?
Oh, you know, they want to know about the experience. I think there's a lot of questions about even, you know, just how in the world this documentary came to be in the first place.
That's a good question, right?
You know, what these kids thought of us coming into their homes, and what they thought our intentions were, and how they felt about it, and ultimately how our relationship, you know, grew over time, and all of that. I think there's always a bit of a joke. First met Andrew, he was practicing his fighting skills in the park and was really kind of posturing that he was a tough guy. And this is a lot of the image that these, you know, young kids put off. You know, it's a bit of a self-defense mechanism, you know, that they're okay, and that they're tough and nothing really gets to them. And then we went home with Andrew and met his family and his mother and his sister and his dad, and they weren't letting him play the tough guy. You know, his mother wouldn't let him swear in front of us, and he was instantly, you know, the tough guy demeanor just, you know, fell away.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember he jokes that when he first met my cousin and co-director on the other line here, he thought he was a cop. and was a little, you know, and then he did his research and looked us up and, you know, found out that we were legitimate and asked around about us, and we became friends, you know.
And what do you do with the camera? Because there are some very intimate moments in this documentary where the conversation, there might be disagreements that are taking place, and some of them are pretty heated disagreements, and it's as though the camera has disappeared for these families. How do you get that to happen?
Well, you know,
I think a lot of it. Oh, sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead, Tracy.
We both have our answers for this. A lot of it is patience. You know, we were there and in these homes for such an extended period of time, and we saw happy times and moments of celebration, and we were also there when things were intense and hard, and I really do feel that at a certain point it wasn't about performing for the camera, or, you know, it was really about us bearing witness, and they were supportive of that and wanted that to happen. But I'm sorry, Andrew, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that I think a lot of it is just about time, our time that we dedicated to spending with them. And, you know, I think people, when you start, you perhaps want some, you know, we had a lot of material which wasn't that interesting. And that's, of course, all on the cutting room floor. But, you know, it's about patience. And also, I think we were very honest with them about what we had hoped this film might be. And I think in that, then they, you know, were more honest with us. And I think that really helped our film.
We will welcome phone calls if you'd like to join us. We're speaking with the directors and producers of Rich Hill, which is going to premiere on PBS on Independent Lens next Monday, January 5. The directors' producers are Tracy Droz Tragos and Andrew Droz Palermo. They are cousins. Rich Hill, Missouri is the hometown of their parents. And this film focuses on three teenage boys and looks at them in all their complexity and their relationship with their families. It's a town where there just isn't a lot of work, and as a result of that, families struggle, really struggle, and there aren't many services either, as Tracy was saying. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If any of you are success stories from small towns where there don't seem to be a whole lot of financial opportunities in terms of jobs, how did you plan out your lives? Did you find it necessary to leave? At what age did you do that? Or is there a way to flourish in small-town America that's not very affluent? 800-486-8655 is our number, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at this time, we're going to be talking about handwriting. The Common Core standards call for cursive to be taught in kindergarten and first grade, but no attention paid to it thereafter. Some are concerned about this. Our guest, Dr. Virginia Berninger, is a psychologist, and she's done a great deal of research on cursive writing, and says that children who compose text by hand consistently produce more words more quickly than they do on a keyboard and express more ideas. So before we give up cursive, perhaps we should listen to what she has to say. And we will tomorrow. 800-486-8655 is our number. Let me ask both of you, starting with you, Tracy, to make a film like this, which is about a forgotten part of America. I'm wondering if it's difficult to get funds together. Do people want to do an examination? If we ignore these people, usually, why would we want to pay attention and make a film about them now that you could get funding for? Was that a struggle for you?
Well, indeed it was. Yeah, you know, it's not a story that has a hook or that necessarily even has a happy ending. So, you know, it was absolutely a film that Andrew and I struggled to raise funds for. It was a year that we were in production. It was on my credit cards, which was kind of a scary thing for me and my family, because, you know, I have two children and a husband and all the rest. But I believed in this film, and I knew that ultimately if we could spend enough time with it, that we could convince supporters to get behind us. And indeed we did. The Sundance Documentary Fund was our first money in after a year, and then the MacArthur Foundation came in with a grant which allowed us to finish production, and these were just it was invaluable support. But yeah, we had to be in production for a year before we really could convince anyone of the fact that, you know, this was an important story to tell. You know, and in part because it was a film, and what was the ending going to be?
Right,
you know?
Right.
And in some measure, you know, the ending is still unknown.
Right. Let's go to Richard in River Falls. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Kathleen. Very interesting show, and I just kept thinking about the show that I happened to hear last week when you were interviewing the author of the book, the refugee from South Vietnam,
yes,
who at 3 years old, he and his family were, what they went through and the results of that, and came to this country knowing that there would be opportunity, and there was. And what I can't understand is how somebody would say there's no opportunities left. That wasn't that long ago. I really believe that there's an awful lot of opportunities, and I think it's just that people have to, they might have to move. They might have to take a Greyhound bus to North Dakota or to Texas or someplace like that. And yeah, but there's people crying for jobs, they're crying for employees all over this country, but they have to be willing to probably move or pull up stakes. So I'll take, that's my comment.
Thanks,
and,
Richard.
Thanks for the show, and I'll listen on the air.
Thank you. Tracy?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, in some measure, he's right. It's just a question when people are really living so much on the line and hand to mouth, sometimes the ability to move to the city and somehow, you know, have a place to live and have a place to, you know, a way to get your kids in school and to have what they need. It's more expensive to live in the city. Everything costs more. And, of course, that's where the jobs are. But it's that catch-22 of can you make it there? And some families just can't make it there. But for sure, I mean, there is still opportunity out there. It just, you know, I believe based on the year and a half that I spent with these families that it isn't just enough to work hard and have ambition. You know, sometimes these families really do need a leg up, because poverty isn't just due to some kind of moral deficiency, or isn't necessarily due to a moral deficiency at all. It is often due to, you know, a series of bad lucks, and it's not an equal playing field.
No.
So the opportunity that there may exist for some really doesn't exist for all.
Thank you both so much. Good luck with the premiere next Monday night, and thank you for making the film. Our guests this hour, Tracy Droz-Tragos and Andrew Droz Palermo, independent filmmakers, the documentary Rich Hill, next Monday night on PBS. Check your local listings. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, and thank you for listening.